human frailty is everywhere apparent today, and no more so than in the text that is before us. If you'll please take out your scripture sheet, we're working our way through the Sermon on the Mount. We come to some very delicate topics, which I will try to treat in a delicate manner. I've given this sermon the title, The Heart of the Matter. You notice it begins with two references to adultery and closes with two references. That tells us that Matthew intends this to be read as a paragraph. At the center in verses 29 and 30 are Jesus' remedy, which is radical surgery on the self. Jesus speaks in the Sermon on the Mount to his disciples and to the crowds. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks continually at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go to hell. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, makes her an adulteress. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. This is the word of the Lord. Now, what is Pastor Phil going to do with this text? The 1998 movie Hope Floats is about a woman struggling to recover from her husband's infidelity. Bertie Pruitt, played by Sandra Bullock, thinks she's going on a national TV show to receive a makeover, only to discover that once she gets there, the real purpose of the program is to uncover her husband's affair with her best friend in front of a national audience. Horrified, Bertie returns to her small-town Texas home to put life back together. There she faces considerable obstacles and the potential rebirth of an old high school romance. Towards the end of the film, Bertie and her husband argue loudly in front of their daughter about the pain and deceit the adultery caused. She shouts, I would have stayed with you forever. I would have turned myself inside out for you. But her husband Bill won't hear it. He says he's finally found happiness for himself and he's going to take it. Finally, Bertie tells him to leave since she got the best part of him anyway, namely their daughter Bernice. Bill turns to go and is pursued by Bernice down the stairs and out to the car. She calls out, I'm coming with you, Daddy. But her dad keeps walking. The little girl, terrified by the loss of her father, tries to get in the car with him, begging, Daddy, I need you, but he refuses. He says sternly, I promise to come back to you, but I'm starting a new life with Connie now. As she screams and sobs, his raised voice has an empty ring as he says over and over, I promise, I promise, I promise. With that, he drives off, leaving Bernice completely devastated, waiting until her mother comes to pick her up. How many times has that scene been repeated in our lifetime? This is what God wants his people to avoid. And that is why, when you narrow it down to only 10, this had better be one of them. You shall not commit adultery. Among God's people, there are to be no predators. There are to be no home wreckers. No adultery is a boundary to protect something that is good and fragile and precious and warmly human. And the promise hidden in the command is that the best is to be found at home, which it is your job to nurture since you took those precious promises. Do you remember them? To have and to hold from this day forward, to love and to cherish until we are parted by death. If Lori doesn't feel cherished, I'm not doing my job. Don't look for life and joy elsewhere. Develop the character and the understanding and the prayer to keep the home fires burning. And when the words of Jesus are invoked at every wedding, those whom God has joined together, let no man put asunder. The intent is to warn everyone present that to undermine your own marriage or that of another is to make God your enemy. A God who is fully able to frustrate people at every turn. Why did Jesus say such a strong thing? Because he knows that people will discount and deface something God created, the potential for which is stamped into our gendered bodies. The hardware of Christian marriage is undeniable biological complementarity. And if that is the hardware, the software is the relationship of love that builds between a man and woman towards a publicly blessed marriage that is consummated and celebrated in private all the days of their life. This is God's work, and it is a great gift to the human family for the raising of children in the faith, for the channeling of our sometimes unruly biological desires and the deepening of one relationship, and for the creating of little units of love and little economies that we call families that are a stability to every society. What ballast does for a sailing vessel, stable marriages do for a culture. They keep us from tipping over. All the studies show that children do better with married biological parents. We know that, as do all school teachers, even if we're hesitant to say so in our politically correct world. There is forgiveness after adultery, though the marriage may not survive. But one of the hidden stories of our culture is what happens to people who violate their vows and never repent. It is a sad, sad story to find people frustrated in what they do because they have never gone to God with an honest confession and received His forgiveness. As I read the Ten Commandments this week, I discovered something I had not seen before, that no adultery is not the only pro-marriage commandment among the ten. What is honor your father and mother but honoring their marriage that gave you life? And what about the tenth commandment? You shall not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife, which goes beyond wrong action to a corrupted imagination. And if I were to write a footnote to the commandment against adultery for our day, it would be this brief footnote: no pornography in the homes of my people. No 50 shades of gray on the bedside table. Nothing dangerous or shameful or demeaning. Put your best energies into your own marriage. Become a great lover to your spouse. Do whatever you have to do to avoid a wandering eye, because if you make lust a habit of character, you cannot endure the light of God's kingdom. Jesus is very clear and very countercultural. You simply do not want over time to become the kind of person that sees men and women as disposable. And that is what our culture does by saturating us in sensual, hyper-erotic imagery. People have dignity because they're made in God's image and because Christ has come for them. And to reduce them to a collection of disposable parts is a moral evil. It is not innocent and has harmful effects on those who produce it and consume it. It is an industry that mocks the tenderest feelings of which we are capable. Passions that God designed by complex neurochemistry to bond a man and woman together in a durable bond that has the chance to go to distance. I recently read a legal study from the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. And here are some of the recent statistics. 56% of divorces in America involve a partner with a serious porn addiction. 68% involve an affair that was started on the internet. You can go on the internet and find services that will help you commit adultery. Who will say no to this modern form of insanity if not the Church of Jesus Christ? The temptation to lust and adultery has always been there, which is why Jesus called it a moral cancer and says that you must cut it out. But we are in the midst of a digital revolution that has changed everything. And we're learning from brain scans that exposure to explicit material literally burns new neural pathways in people's brain in an insatiable addiction. We have crossed a new frontier into universal instant availability, what some therapists are calling crack cocaine for the eyes. Now, folks, our Christian perspective is not about avoiding human beauty. It's not about not delighting in the perpetual dance of energy between men and women. It's not being prudish about the body or honoring the circuits for pleasure which the Maker has wired into us all. It's about deliberately choosing to swim against the overwhelming tides of a sleazy culture and to make sure we become one woman kind of men and one man kind of females. And that Jesus enables this. And you think about it. The 12 disciples were 12 young Jewish working guys between their late teens and their early 30s. We know that Peter was married, and we know that most of them were probably married if the statistics hold. But Jesus called them to leave their wives and the security of village life for weeks and months on end and to travel the road with him, sometimes with unaccompanied females who were also his disciples. Where do you think today's teaching came from? My guess is that one evening, Jesus called the 12 guys aside out of the hearing of the female disciples, and it may have gone like this. I've been watching your eyes and your whispered remarks as we pass through the villages, and I say to you tonight that everyone who continually looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her with his heart. And if you guys have to become one-eyed or left-handed, so be it. Do not become a man who turns women into objects, because the garbage dump of hell is a lot higher than the hottest flames of passion. Treat women with the dignity and love that I do. They are your sisters. Hear their stories. Welcome their friendship. But keep your marriage vows intact by learning to guard your imagination. Ask the Spirit to help you. I do not want your wives to think that you following me destroyed their lives. Now, folks, Jesus had all the same feelings we do, including affection. And he had as much testosterone as any of his followers. And he was tempted as we are. But he never thought as a woman as an object to be used, because he saw in them the shattered image of God that he had come to heal. Jesus was the only whole person who ever lived. All his passions were under his self-control. He was fully masculine. And when he looked at a woman in love, she did not shudder in fear, because his love went all the way down to the bone. He grew up as a village guy in a village where there's no privacy. He heard the banter and jokes. He learned about men and women. But he was utterly disarming and different. And women were powerfully drawn to him, because there was never a leer. There was never an agenda. And when he touched people, they felt the love of God. It is not enough to avoid adultery, said Jesus. We must tame the desire to even think of other people as objects for our gratification. Lust and the pain and degradation that flows from it shatters respect. People die from STDs. The unborn die of convenience abortions. Childhood innocent dies from molestation. Marriages die from adultery. Reputations die because of lust. Consciences die from toxins. Respect between parents and children dies when dad or mommy's little secrets are found out. And death is everywhere in the culture. It has adopted a Hugh Hefner philosophy of casual connections with no consequences. It's not sophisticated fun. It's the destruction of people's capacity for monogamy. A holy union is turned into a hookup. A soul-to-soul bond becomes temporary, skin-to-skin contact. The church is not prudish. The church is all for education. But I'll just tell you, as a pastor who deals with the casualties, it is everywhere. And it is a plague upon the land. The Jewish world into which Jesus came was a man's world. Adultery was then considered a property crime because men owned women. As in parts of the Muslim world today, women were blamed for men's problems, which is why in some countries they have to cover themselves up. But Jesus said that a male problem with out-of-control desire is not because of the woman's beauty. She is not to be blamed. It is because of a diseased passion in the heart of a man. And it comes out in his eyes. And in his imagination, and in leering looks. And if it does not stop there, it moves to his hand and touch, and on to treating another person as if they were disposable. And no one is disposable to God. And so in a world where women were blamed, Jesus said the problem must be located in the heart of a man. And that is itself a sobering idea. Now this week, down at the Cancer Center in Greenwood, something will happen like this. Someone will come in with symptoms. They'll do tests and CAT scans. And the doctor will walk in and say, "I have some bad news. You have a cancer, and it has spread. And to save your life, this is what we must do. We must cut you open. We must take out the cancer. We must fry you with radiation and poison you with chemotherapy. And if you are willing to do this, we may be able to save your life." And people say yes, because life is precious. But Jesus said that men with wandering eyes and wandering hands must do surgery on themselves. And he's not talking about plucking out eyes or cutting off hands. He's talking about his followers to be a new kind of man. A man of dignity and self-control and love and strength, and one who honors all women and who pours their vital energies only into their old marriage. And I tell you, this is a battle that men face not just in their teenage years, but across the whole of their life. And it is a battle that we must all win if we are to have integrity and to be followers of Jesus Christ. Two Buddhist monks walked in a downpour. They came to a stream swollen out of its banks. A beautiful kimono-clad woman stood there, afraid to cross because of the currents. One of the monks said, "Can I help you?" "I need to cross this stream," she said. The monk picked her up, put her on his shoulders, carried her through the water, and put her down on the other side. He and his companion then went on to the monastery in absolute silence. That night, the one said to the other, "I have a bone to pick with you. We monks have taken vows not to look on a woman, much less touch her, but by the river you did both." "My brother, I put the woman down on the other side of the river. You still carry her in your mind. Who has the problem?" The goal of Jesus is that we live with freedom and integrity, that there be no harassment, but there'd be a deep, rich, mutual, humorous liveliness between men and women. And Jesus did not mind the threats and fears of hell to get the attention of his disciples when he saw them leering at women when they went into village after village. The book of Hebrews says, "Let marriage be held in honor among all." Now, in the day of Jesus, some of the rabbis had come up with opinions that allowed a man to divorce his wife not just for adultery, but if he found someone prettier, or even if she burned the toast. It was called any cause divorce, and it developed a few decades before Jesus. So Jesus entered a world of male privilege where Jewish men were thinking they could be right with God and engage in serial monogamy for trivial reasons. And he spoke against it. He said that adultery violates a marriage. But in that culture, if men were throwing away women for trivial causes, it was creating a web of adultery across the land. Jesus is not engaging in pastoral care with difficult modern circumstances. Jesus is upholding marriage by making his followers treat women as precious, powerful, dignified, bearers of God's image. Jesus does not want men trading in women as if they were trading in used cars. And so I leave you and me with five challenges. If there's anything offensive in your home, please throw it out. Second, read a book on addiction so you understand the process. These things come in clusters. And if you have a lust problem, you probably have other addictions as well. Third, take up the spiritual disciplines of fasting and exercise. I find that saying no to my belly once a week and trying to work out at the gym gives me self-control in many other areas of my life. Fourth, find a friend that you can unburden to and can hold you accountable. And finally, remember that you are worth saving and that nothing much will happen in your life without a surrender. Something has to die in you, and you must put it to death. You must pluck it out and throw it away. Letting convictions run your life instead of your impulses is the only way to Christian freedom. Jesus is waiting for men and women to take him seriously. And he has more good for us than we can imagine. And folks, this is not the whole of his teaching. And the church is not fixated on this issue. This is only a small part of his teaching. But it is perhaps the one area that most challenges our self-indulgent culture these days. And therefore, I cannot avoid it for your comfort. The church has a better idea, a more humane idea, a more joyful and lively idea. It is better for people. And we must commend it to our world. And we must live deeply into it ourselves. Recognize there is brokenness. There's also healing. And I thank you for your patience as I have tried to deal gingerly with the words of Jesus in an honest and sensitive manner. Brian Wren is an amazing English hymn writer. And in 1978, he wrote a hymn which only 10 years later found its way into our Methodist hymnal. It is titled, "When Love is Found." And as you sing this hymn, see if it does not move you through the stages of your own marriage. Let us stand and sing together.